G'day wherever you are around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Treasures from the Tanakh on Truth to You. That's truth2u.org. Don't forget to sign up for the weekly newsletter, and you can also keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Jono, and joining me is Torah teacher Ira Michelson. G'day, Ira.
Poker Tov, Jono, and it's Poker Tov for you and Erev Tov for me.
That is correct. It's bright in the morning here and evening where you are. And thank you for coming back on, my friend, because once again, now we've gotten through Bildad and his response to Job. Job has the opportunity to reply. And we're talking, of course, about Job chapter 9. In my Bible, in the New King James Study Bible that I have in front of me, it has little subheadings, and this one's entitled Job, There Is No Mediator. And yep, well, that's what it says. And it begins like this. You ready?
Go ahead. Here we go.
Then Job answered and said, Truly, I know it is so. Well, he knows what is so. He knows he's responding to Bildad. And, you know, this is what we were talking about last week, that Bildad sort of adds a little bit of sandpaper into the mix, kind of, you know, has the opportunity to smooth things over in the last couple of verses. Maybe I should read those first. He said from verse 20, Behold, God will not cast away the blameless, nor will he uphold the evildoers. He will yet fill your mouth with laughing and your lips with rejoicing. Those who hate you will be clothed in shame, and the dwelling place of the wicked will come to nothing. And this is what Job is answering to. He said, Truly, I know it is so. But how can a man be righteous before God? If one wishes to contend with him, he could not answer him one time out of a thousand. God is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who has hardened himself against him and prospered? He removes the mountains and they do not know when he overturns them in his anger. He shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble. He commands the sun and it does not rise. He seals off the stars. He alone spreads out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea. He made... Now, what... Can, verse 9, do we want to go back, or can I get you to read verse 9 in Hebrew?
Oh, no, we got to go back.
Let's go back first. Let's go back before we get to verse 9.
We got to go back to the beginning. You want to go through 9 verses and not talk about anything. I mean, so yeah, he's answering, but he's answering one of the verses before what you actually read. He's answering in similar language, Job chapter 4, verse 17. Which says Anashme Eloha Yitzak Imo Maasehu Yitcha Gaver, where it's is man more righteous than Eloha, than his maker, is a man more pure. So we see this kind of similar language where he's saying, Look, I know that man's that man can't be righteous. Mm-hmm. And he's answering specifically that verse. But I want to kind of explore an alternative to this, you know, right at the beginning.
Sure.
And fit it into the context that we started at the beginning of the show, which was this idea of the courtroom drama that started with the divine counsel and the divine mm-hmm. court that we talked about. Mm-hmm. He's basically saying, can a man be just by God if from his maker he is purified? And so what happens is both Eliphaz and Job seem to indicate that compared to God, there's always some flaw. That precludes man from being wholly righteous, you know, or being a tzaddik. And this would kind of imply that Job agrees with Eliphaz, which the rest of the chapter doesn't support. So we kind of see this. Remember, we're going to see this throughout, that there's kind of certain things that they say that are true, that Job's going to respond to, and he's going to say, yeah, okay, I agree. That's absolutely true. However, it's kind of like half-truths. And there's a very interesting take on this from one of the rabbinic commentators, from Rashi, who is considered one of the, you know, the greatest, you know, rabbinic Torah commentators. And this is on Parsha Mishpatim, and he references Exodus chapter 23, verse 7, which says, "Midvar shekel tirchak v'naki v'tzadik al taharog ki lo atzdik rasha." Which translates, keep far from a false word, do not mm-hmm. bring death upon the clean and the just, because I will not acquit the wicked. And what he says there is, see, there's two interesting things that we see there. What I read was, midvar sheker tichak, these two words, vinaki vitzadik. And what he says is that there's a difference in this verse between the naki and between the tzadik. One is called the clean. and one is called the Just. Okay, and what he says is that the former one, the Naki, refers to one that is truly sinless, but the latter just means that he won his court case, not that he is without sin. Which is a very interesting take on this, especially when in the context that we're talking about. And so Eov is not admitting, Job is not admitting that he has some sin, but by slightly changing Eliphaz's words and Bildad's words, he's saying that there is no way he can win the court case against God. And I think this is the idea supported by the rest of the text in the chapter and what we're going to see going forward, which is why I'm so excited about seeing this courtroom language and this legal language that's going on here. And he's basically saying, look, Bildad, you're right. God does oppose the wicked. There is punishment for sin, and God does reward the righteous. He shares the viewpoint of his friends, but they try to put this kind of in this neat package, you know, of kind of standardizing the theology. And he's saying, look, it doesn't work for me, you know, what you're saying. It doesn't fit into the situation that I find myself in.
And this could be Job being reduced to self pity, as you know, as he sort of has expressed. But this might just be the next stage down, in a sense. It's interesting, and I do want to focus in on one of the concepts that you mentioned when we get to verse 22.
Right.
But you're quite
because
right.
Because he's saying, look, how can anyone be righteous before God? I mean, this is what we're going to start getting into now. And basically, he's getting to the point where he's saying, look, if what I was doing before wasn't good enough, then how can anyone ever be good enough? He thought he was righteous. And God said he was. God said he was blameless.
Amen.
You know, he was Ish Tam. He was a blameless man. And that's exactly the point. The point is that really we can't ever do anything good enough. You know, Isaiah 64:6, our righteousness are filthy rags.
Sure.
That doesn't mean that we stop doing good. It just means that the righteousness of God is far above the righteousness of man.
Amen.
And this is really a devastating idea, you know.
And that reminds me again, of course. I mean, I think I did quote from Jeremiah 17 last week, but and if I remember correctly, from verse 5 to verse 8, but in verse 9 of Jeremiah 17, of course, it says, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? I, the Lord, I, Yehovah, search the heart. I test the mind. I give to every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his doings." But most certainly, in comparison to the perfection of Yah, our heart is by comparison, is wicked.
Yes, deceitful. Absolutely. Very, very much so.
And he makes this point. Anyway, we will get to that, but it's certainly a theme throughout this particular chapter. So verse 9.
Wait. What do you mean verse 9?
I'm really curious about
one verse. We still have five or six more verses for you to go through here. I'm not letting you off the hook here. So, you know, we have to remember that Bildad called him a windbag last week. You know, I mean, at least Eliphaz didn't really, you know, get so personal and, you know, basically called him a windbag, that he's full of hot air. You know, of course, the Hebrew, I said, actually means a destructive wind. And then we see in verse 3 of chapter 8 last week, you know, where he says, "Will God pervert justice, and will the Almighty pervert righteousness?" And we have to keep those kind of in the back of our mind when we go forward, because it's so important to remember the context of justice that was brought by Bildad, because this is going to be the main theme of this chapter. And
right.
So he said in verse 3, he says, "If he should want to contend with him, he will not answer him one in a thousand." Mm-hmm. And actually, this word in Hebrew, it says im yachpots, okay? If he would contend, but actually Yachpots comes from Chafetz. We actually see that in Psalm 34. It's actually one of my favorite verses, because it comes from an old Jewish song that we used to sing in synagogue when I was a kid, from Isaiah 34, where it says, "Mi ha'ish ha'chafetz chaim," who is the man that desires life? And so it's talking about this desire that he has. So he says, even if I delighted, even if I desired in bringing a court case against God, you know, I'd be online with 1,000 other people. I can't even be sure they would listen to my case. or that one trying to do so or trying to justify himself before God, would he even be able to answer God when God addresses him? And this is something that he brings forward in these next couple of verses. You know, Chacham Leviv, wise in heart and mighty in power, who has hardened himself toward him and was safe. He's basically saying, look, you can never win an argument with God. This is where he's starting to, like, make his case against God now. You see, he's been up to a point, you know, he's kind of been answering them. But now he's kind of transitioning into this realm of bringing a court case before God. And he's using his friends that came now as the witnesses and the judges of the court case. Because he basically says, look, he's always going to be right, and anybody that comes against him is always going to be wrong. You can't defy God and get away with it. Why? Because, look, he is the God who removes mountains.
That's right. But it's futile. He knows it's futile, and yet he kind of sets it up, and he sets it up quite pessimistically, saying, you know, I can, you know, we can do this, but I'm going to lose regardless.
Right, and so in these middle verses now, when you start reading about he who removes mountains and they do not know which in his anger he overthrows, it actually alludes to the idea of, and you're going to see this as we go through these next couple of verses, it actually alludes to these kind of events in our world that would seem to be natural events that are really controlled by God. And what he's basically saying is he's talking about volcanoes here. Almost that. That look, this is the God that moves mountains. There are volcanoes that happen across the world that we don't know about. You know, look, we don't always hear about what's going on in your end of the world. You know, I know that there, you know, there've been some really bad, you know, earthquakes, and we're going to get to that as well. And so we have this idea of volcanoes in verse 5 and verse 6. Who causes the land to shake from its place and its pillars shudder? This is talking about earthquakes that shake the land. Both on the surface and in the depths below. And then in verse 7, who speaks to the sun. And this is really interesting because, again, this is one of those obscure Hebrew words where it says, Ha'omer la'cheres, and cheres being sun. It's the only time that you can find this. I mean, this is the only time I see that word used for sun. Usually we see other words for sun. I haven't been able to find any other time. Where it's used. So he speaks to the sun and it does not appear, and he seals up the stars. And so the first part of this verse could actually refer simply to the nighttime hours when the sun is not visible. However, if we're looking at these verses that we saw before in the same way that we just read about what I believe are earthquakes, now we read about another event that can only be from the hand of God. And that's, I think, what we're looking at is an eclipse here. So we're looking at a total eclipse when the sun disappears behind a dark moon. And the sealing of the stars that it's talking about could simply refer to the daylight hours in general when the nighttime stars are hidden from view. But here's a very interesting thing, that this could also refer to the mysterious appearance and then the sudden disappearance of the stars in the daytime that takes place during a total eclipse. Because when a total eclipse comes, you can actually see them really quickly, and then they disappear. And then in verse 8, of course, you read, Notesh Shemayim Levado V'Dorech Al Bimate Yam, who alone stretches out to heaven and treads on the heights of the sea. And so the first part of this verse is an allusion for me to creation, you know, in the stretching out of the heavens, with the heaven stretched out like a tent above us. And the second part for me is kind of an allusion to God's power over the sea. And because we're talking about major events like earthquakes and volcanoes you know, the eclipse, this could very well be talking about the flood. And I think we'll see language like this moving forward in a couple of verses. And we see similar language to this in a couple of verses in the Tanakh. One is Amos chapter 4, verse 13. Which says, "Behold, he who formed the mountains and created the wind, and has told man what his thought is, who turns blackness into daybreak and treads upon the heights of the earth, Yehovah Elohei Tzivaot is his name." And then
there's one in the Psalms too, isn't there?
Yeah, there is one similar in the Psalms.
Yeah,
actually, a couple. I think Psalm 135, and there's one earlier in Psalm. I want to say 80. Psalm 80, I can't remember now.
I can't remember either.
In Micah 1:3, it says, "Behold, Jehovah is coming forth from his dwelling place. Mm-hmm. He will come down and walk upon the heights of the earth." So it's just this idea of walking upon the heights, not necessarily the water, but now we see the water here. And then we get to your verse that you want to come to, okay? Where it says, "Oseh as hisil v'chima v'hadrei teman." And we go, what the heck does this mean? You know, what does it mean? What does your Bible say, Jonah? What does it translate?
So what I've got is, he made the bear, Orion, and the, what's that?
Pleiades.
Pleiades. Uh-huh. And the chambers, plural, of the south.
Uh-huh.
What?
Yeah, exactly. What?
Now, well, I read that and I think these are star constellations, right?
Yeah.
And so, the chambers of the south, well, I don't know.
Okay, so based on what we've been talking about, we can obviously make this argument. We're talking about all these events that you would seem, most people that don't believe in Jehovah would think are natural events. But now we see this concept of these constellations. And some translations identify this as the Great Bear, which is often referred to as the Big Dipper. But here's a very interesting thing. That word as can actually mean, in other verses, moth, related to a moth, or decay. Why would it be decay? Because we know about moths. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, they used to put mothballs in the closet so that the mm-hmm. moths would eat through the clothing. And kisil can actually mean a fool. In other words, when you look at this idea of constellations in that context, we kind of could see like a play on words here, that it's a fool of a god in the stars, meaning that it could be talking about the idea of, and certainly Job and his friends would know about this, being men of the East, mm-hmm. And living amongst the people who would see constellations as deities, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then we see this word chima, which can mean a cluster, which would kind of be related to this idea of Pleiades that we see. But sure. The most important thing that we learn here is that that since God made these things, they're obviously not to be worshipped. And another verse that I think could bring clarity is actually in the same book. And this is where we get into that idea of the chambers of the south. And this is from Job chapter 37, verse 9. It says, "Min hacheder tavo sufa umim mizraim kara." Okay, and what that means is, from the chamber goes out the whirlwind, and from the north the cold. But this word mimzarim in Job 37:9 is also translated in the JPS as constellations. So from the chambers go out the whirlwind, and from the north the cold, and from so it's actually talking about the constellations there.
Hmm.
And so the chamber of the south, they're talking really more about the south, the southern constellations as opposed to the northern constellations. And
just,
that is
just
one of the trends.
So, I mean, but so it's talking about the, that he controls the weather perhaps. But it doesn't actually say of the south or of the north, right? In 37:9, it says from the chambers comes the whirlwind and cold from the scattering winds.
Right.
How do we, while we're there, how do we place that, the assumption that it talks about the south and the north? I mean, I'm sure we'll probably deal with that in detail when we get there, but it is interesting whenever you see the italics in your Bible and you think, yeah, that's not there.
Well, because this is the thing. You got to understand that Mizarim, okay, could actually be the north as well, okay?
And you know, and I suppose that in the context followed by verse 10 where it says, by the breath of God, ice is given. So we're still talking about wind, and we're talking about icy wind. We're talking about snow. We're talking about weather events. And we know that they come from the poles, and it continues, and the broad waters are frozen. And so that makes sense. Again, in verse 11, weather events, climate events, also with moisture, he saturates the thick clouds. He scatters his bright clouds, and they swirl around, being turned by his guidance, that they may do whatever he commands. So on the face of the whole earth. So I suppose that it does make sense to deduce from that it is talking about weather events. And when we're talking about ice and cold and cloud, then we're talking about winds coming from the poles. I suppose that does make sense here.
Right. And so like if I look at the root and kind of, you know, see the root of Zara there, then we're talking about north. And this is why some of the translations bring north. But there are other translations that translate this. When we see Umim Zarim, they translate it as constellations. And this is the thing that you get into when you get into the poetic language. So this is where you kind of have to be the detective, and you have to go in and you have to see, okay, where else do we see not necessarily something similar to this, but we see, you know. So what I did was I went in and tried to, you know, to look up this idea of the cheder or chedre, you know, these chamber, the chamber or the chambers, to see if I could find something similar. And of course, this is when I came up with, you know, Job 37:9, which and you just read a couple of verses forward, which really speaks to giving us good context about that. But it's certainly all of this that we're seeing, again, within these middle verses that we read between the beginning and between verse 9, was this idea of all of these cosmic events that are taking place and all of them being attributed to Yehovah. And certainly this is what he's saying. He's saying it in context of like, look, you know, I hear you. You know, how could I come against this God? How can I come against Yehovah? How can I bring my case to him with all that he is and all that he does?
Amen. And so he goes on to say he does great things past finding out. Yes, wonders without number. If he goes by me, I do not see him. If he moves past, I do not perceive him. If he takes away, who can hinder him? Who can say to him, what are you doing? God will not withdraw his anger. The allies of the proud, now I want to ask you about this, the allies of the proud lie prostrate beneath him. Now, I've got an asterisk there in 13, the allies of asterisk, the proud, and I go down and it says Rahab. What is Rahab?
Okay, so let's go back first. Let's just deal with a couple of these verses first. Okay, so I just want to, you know, I mean, I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but when I see something that's, you know, pretty interesting word, I just want to touch on it. So certainly in verse 11, where it says, behold, he passes over me, it actually means, it could mean passes over him like a razor. you know, it has that connotation. Or it could actually mean like passing over transgression. At the same time, it could be either one. And so I guess it depends on your context. I mean, if you've been sitting there scraping your flesh with, you know, pot shards.
You had to do it, didn't you?
Yeah, I had to. And behold, verse 12, behold, if he snatches away, who can return him? Who says to him, what are you doing? And so that word snatch there is the word actually, henyach tof at the beginning of the verse comes from chataf. And it's used here, it's like the action of a thief, like when a thief tries to steal something away. We see this actually in Proverbs chapter 23, verse 28. It says, af hi kichetef. And it's actually in verse 27, it's actually relating this to a harlot. And then in verse 28, it says, she too lies in wait as if for prey and destroys the unfaithful among men. So he's talking about it like almost like, you know, the snatching away is like that God is waiting, you know, for him like prey in a sense. And then it says, Eloah, God does not turn back his anger. And it says, beneath him they crouch, the helpers of Rahav. Okay? All right, so what is this? So this is another allusion to religious beliefs outside of Israel. We kind of just talked about that, you know, the possibility of worshiping constellations as deities, so forth outside of, you know, in the pagan cultures outside of Israel. Mm-hmm. And Rahav actually can mean arrogance or rage, okay, as a literal translation. Mm-hmm. And Rahav often refers to, when you do a study on it, kind of similar to what we've talked about before when we talked about the plesiosaur, you know, Leviathan. Okay, this is also considered kind of this monster or dragon that's found in the creation stories of actually surrounding societies. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We see this in Psalm 89, verse 9 and 10 in the Hebrew. I think it's 10 and 11 in the English. And it says, Atam mushal begeut hayam b'shug alav ata tishabchem ata dikita kechalal rahav bizroa uscha pizarta oivecha. Okay, you rule the swelling of the sea. I wanted to bring this because you see this. Again, we're talking about the sea here mm-hmm. and cosmic events. You rule the swelling of the sea. When its waves surge, you still them. And I put emphasis on surge for a reason. You crushed Rahav. He was like a corpse. With your powerful arm, you scattered your enemies. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of surging that we see comes from the idea of the restlessness and the crashing of the sea related to this, you know, this Rahav. And so in the same way that we are seeing allusions to all these events that most people would consider natural, like I said, like the earthquakes and eclipses, and certainly here in the United States, actually in Florida, we're getting ready for a hurricane here. We have Hurricane Isaac that's in the Caribbean right now, and they're saying that, you know, it's going to hit somewhere in Florida, and we're bracing here in central Florida for it. And so in the same way that we're seeing these kind of things, we now kind of see an allusion to the flood, okay? And I'm talking about specifically the flood, mm-hmm. okay, in the days of Noah. And why would a dragon be associated with the flood? Well, look, for the same reason the dragons have been associated with the sea in old maps, if you look at ancient maps, mm-hmm. or look, we even have in you know, movies and things like that, the sea monsters and dragons are always related to the sea and the old-time sailors.
Sure.
And we know that they were once the largest creatures in the sea, and so came to be seen as a symbol of waters, of the waters in the sea. Mm-hmm. And so in the same way, at the time of the flood, the raging waters would have been closely associated with the destruction of millions of these, not only millions of people, but millions of, you know, these monsters or dragons, or even if you want to say like the plesiosaur that we attributed to Leviathan. It's obvious that at some time there were creatures like this. Mm-hmm. And so I see this as kind of an allusion to God's absolute victory in the flood that Job is bringing up. And it would be easy to see that like these monsters were destroyed in the flood, so too were the helpers of arrogance, of surging, and of restlessness.
Sure. Okay. Thanks for that.
Yeah.
Rahav. How then can I answer him and choose my words to reason with him? For though I were righteous, I could not answer him. I would beg for mercy. I would beg mercy of my judge. If I called and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice.
I would not trust is actually the Hebrew.
Really?
Yeah, it says, if I called and he answered me, I would not trust that he hears my voice.
Hmm.
And this is where he begins to, and this is where he starts singing his theme song again.
Here it is.
For that's like gloom, despair.
Yeah, misery. And so it says, for he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause.
For nothing. He bruises me with a storm and multiplies my wounds for nothing.
Oh, man.
Even if he answered me, I wouldn't believe that he heard me, since he continues to lash out at me.
He will not allow me to catch my breath. And we read earlier, he won't leave him alone even to swallow. Here he says he will not allow me even to catch my breath, but fills me with bitterness. If it is a matter of strength, indeed, he is strong. And if of justice, who will appoint my day in court? Now, I've got
there
in court.
There you go. Here
there
we go.
There it is. Now, in court is in italics, but the context is certainly there. And if of justice, who will appoint my day?
Right. So here we return to the courtroom. And what I see this is, if it is a matter of strength, see, he is mighty. And if of judgment, who will meet me, or who will appear against him, is basically the way that you could translate it. You know, who will appear against him? And what's interesting there is that word is the same word, ya'ad, where we get the word mo'ed, the appointment. Or Moedim, where we talk about the you know, God's appointed times, Jehovah's appointed times. It's that same word. And so it's this idea of, you know, come on, look. If it's a trial of strength, who could overpower God? If it's a matter of justice, who has the authority to call him to account? Who's going to meet me? Who's going to appear against before God? And you have to start noticing the picture that he's starting to paint here. And why I say that is because this is a picture that's shared by so many people. That he is an all-powerful, vindictive judge in the sky that always against you and never gives you a break. He's the god of hellfire and damnation. Is what some that's all that some people see. I mean, we were actually talking in the car earlier, and we were talking about this about people who have gone through the Holocaust, for instance. Mm-hmm. That you have a certain group of people that have gone through the Holocaust whose faith were built up stronger, and then there are a group that have gone through the Holocaust that say that God died at Auschwitz.
Mm.
Because they don't believe they came to this realization that there's no way that there could be a God that will allow something like that to happen. Mm. So there are people that believe that God is this God that takes all the fun out of life, and that and it makes him appear perverse and unkind and unloving. So what people end up doing is they reject him, or they even deny he exists. This is what happens with most atheists. What most atheists can't deal with, and if you've ever read any of Bart Ehrman's work, you know he has debated with guys like Michael Brown and other people, and some of the some of the rabbinic commentators, the modern day ones, and he always brings this issue of suffering and evil. He can't deal with this loving God concept also allowing for there to be evil in the world, like we talked about last week. And so here, I think, is where we're starting to get back at Job's true problem with God, and the same problem that so many millions of other people have. And sure. And I'll bet it's not just since his troubles began that Job felt this way. And I brought this perspective before. And I'm not saying that we're going to hang our hat on this perspective, but we have to remember that he compulsively brought offerings up constantly
for his
sacrificial offerings for his children in Job chapter 1, verse 5.
Mm.
And look, what does Micah 6:7 say? Is the Lord pleased with thousands of rams, with tens of thousands of rivers of oil? He's not. So what can man do to earn God's favor? Nothing that we could ever do or give is going to be great enough. He is too great and he's too powerful. And so in coming to this realization, what I think is that even though Job comes with this great lament, I actually think he has a better understanding of who God is than his friends do. And I've said this before, because their theology is kind of an ABC thing. You know, it's like A equals B equals C. You know, God is God. You sin, you suffer the consequences unless you repent, and that's it. It's almost like this God in a box, where God's just a dispenser, But Job sees that God is infinitely greater than that, and that that nothing we can do compares to him. So in one way, while he's holding on to this concept of his own righteousness, on the other hand, he understands I think God in a better way than they do.
And so he goes on to say, though I were righteous, my own mouth would condemn me. Though I were blameless, it would prove me perverse. I am blameless, yet I do not know myself. I despise my life. And that brings me back again to Jeremiah 17, where it says, the heart is deceitfully wicked. Who can know it? And Job acknowledges, he said, I am blameless, yet I do not know myself. I despise my life. It is... Oh, okay, now verse 22. Let's get to 22. But is there any comment you want to make on 20 and 21?
Okay, no. I mean, look, he's basically saying even if I were in the right, faced with God, my own mouth would condemn me. And what does he mean by this?
Well, he's kind of pleading no contest, right? It's not as if he's pleading I'm guilty. It's not as if he's pleading I'm innocent and God is unjust. He's just pleading I can't win. Even if I am right, I can't win. So I may as well just plead no contest. And
right, because he's basically saying, to a certain extent, he's kind of coming to a certain conclusion here that really my righteousness is nothing before God, and even if even his moral purity, which he thinks he has, is unclean to God. I reject my life. I despise my life.
Yeah. And then he goes on to say, so this is – now I really want to hone in on this, focusing on this if we can.
Sure.
It is all one thing. Therefore, I say, he destroys the blameless and the wicked. Now, that's a loaded statement. And the first thing that came to my mind, Ira, yeah. is Bereshit 18, where Abraham is speaking to God. And he says in verse 23, he said, Abraham came near and said, would you destroy the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there were 50 righteous within the city. Would you also destroy the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous that were in it? Far be it from you that you would do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous should be as the wicked. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right?
Amen.
Here's the problem, because here's Job saying he destroys the blameless and the wicked.
Well, look, he's saying, and we're seeing this idea of again in verse 22, we see that word tam. He just said in the earlier verses, we see that word three times. He was called Ish Tam by God. He called himself Ish Tam. He's calling himself, you know, again, he says that he's tam, he's blameless. Mm-hmm. And So kind of paraphrase to give you my version of the verse in the English, I would say it's all one. It's all the same. It doesn't matter is what he's saying. Therefore, I said that he puts an end to the blameless, the tam, and the wicked. Basically, what he's saying is, in the end, it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter whether I'm righteous or not. It doesn't matter if I'm good or bad, because God destroys the guilty and the guiltless.
Okay, so it's not as if God is punishing the wicked and the innocent suffer within that punishment. This is not what we're seeing here with Job.
No, that's not what we're saying. What he's saying is, what's the point? You know, look, I was blameless. I was righteous. I was doing all these good things. I was bringing sacrifices for my kids. I was living the best that I could before Yehovah, and here I am, blameless before him. I know I haven't done anything wrong. I'm sitting here. He won't even let me breathe. He won't let me swallow. You know, I just despise. Remember, we talked about he's hanging in this balance. Remember that Yehovah allowed the adversary to touch his body, but to not allow him to die. So he's kept him in this balance of near death, but not even being able to die. And he's begging God. He's basically begging God, saying, look, end it. Let me die already.
Finish the job.
Finish the job.
So it reminds me of, in Ecclesiastes, chapter 9, verse 2, all these things come alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good, the clean, and the unclean, and the good, the bad, and the ugly, the good, the clean, and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and to him who does not sacrifice. As is the good, so is the sinner. He who takes an oath is as he who fears an oath. In verse 3, this is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in the heart while they live, and after they go to the dead.
Yeah, look, so here we are, like I said, with a hurricane, you know, bearing down, supposedly hitting somewhere around Florida. And this is not my first rodeo when it comes to hurricanes. I actually lived through the worst hurricane in modern day in Florida, Hurricane Andrew. I lived down right in the middle of that. I lived through the whole thing. And I can remember friends that would go down to the beach, you know, the day before, and they're praying, you know, for Yehovah to you know, through righteousness to make the storm move. And I'm thinking, you know, they're, you know, where do you want them to move to? You know, so that it doesn't hit you, but it hits another city. Or, you know, there are others that were praying, you know, just send it out to sea, you know, and praying for that to happen. And the truth is that, look, there were synagogues that were destroyed in Hurricane Andrew. There were churches that were destroyed in Andrew. There were righteous people's homes and evil people's homes that were destroyed. It was $30 billion in damage. There was no rhyme or reason. And so, yes, there are things that happen. And this is what Job is talking about with the allusion to all these things. That, look, you know, we're not the ones who decide. You know, I was talking to Nehemiah recently, and he said something like this. He said, look, you know, God doesn't run the universe the way we would like him to.
No, we would certainly do it differently, and it probably wouldn't last very long.
Right.
But point made, and he goes on to say in 23, if the scourge slays suddenly, he laughs at the plight of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges.
Right, so let's look back at this verse 23 for a minute, because remember what we talked about a little while back. We talked about the Naki and the Tzaddik. Mm-hmm. And so here we see in this verse, in verse 23 in the Hebrew, it says, Im shot yamit pitom lemasat nikim yilag. Okay, and the nikim that we see there is the plural, okay? Mm-hmm. It, we see the plural word of the nikim, of that clean one that was talked about. The plural of Naki that we spoke about earlier in contrast to the Tzaddik. And we remember what Rashi said, that there's a difference between a Naki and a Tzaddik. The former one refers to the one that is truly sinless, and the latter just means that he won his court case, not that he is without sin. And so that's very interesting within this context. And so that word that we see here that's translated as scourge, could actually be plague, but can also mean flood, which makes perfect sense in the context of the chapter.
Sure.
So when there's a plague or a catastrophe of some kind, it kills the good and bad alike. This is what we're talking about, and this is what you brought in Ecclesiastes, and of course Ecclesiastes and Job, Eov, are very similar. These are the ones, you know, these are the books in Scripture about suffering.
Indeed.
You know, Bildad maintained that the innocent would be back in the end for their troubles, but Job replies in this verse, and he uses this case of the plague to show Bildad that there really is no difference between the righteous and evildoers, for everyone is plagued alike.
And at the end of 24, he asks a very important question. He makes the point. He says, if it is not he, who else could it be?
Right. And so the first argument is the practical one. And here he says, the earth has been given into the power of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges. If not he, then who is it? Mm. This means that if it is not God who caused my pain, then somebody or something else did.
Doesn't believe that to be the case.
Right. But the point is that he's trying, again, remember, within this courtroom drama, he's bringing a case now. He is bringing a case. And so he's saying, and while that something else caused pain, God was lax. You know, he's saying, look, if this is the case we're going to make, that it's something else other than God that caused this, then where was God when this was happening? And of course, we know that this is impossible. You know,
but it's Job. Clearly, ahead, I was just going to say, it's clearly rhetorical. I mean, he asks it in a way that I imagine that his three companions agree. Well, of course, you know, who else could it be? It's obviously God who's doing this.
Right. But remember that Bildad said that although you may experience pain, God would eventually step in and correct your situation.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so here's Job refuting Bildad.
Mm-hmm. True.
Sure. Because if it were just, why wouldn't God eventually step in? And if he wasn't just, why wouldn't God step in? And so to him, he's saying that, look, eventual justice means that until that point, there was injustice. You know, so he's really making a case here. You know, he's making the case that justice from God could not be limited to justice in the end result alone. Mm-hmm. It must be justice throughout. You know, God can't be just sometimes and other times not be just.
Right.
And so this is why he can't understand. You know, he's saying God can't be inactive while someone who is undeserving is going through what he's going through.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the primary breakdown of Bildad, you know, Bildad's argument, you know, that he brings, where he says a scourge really does affect the just people with the wicked. And the second argument addressed God's judgment. Because Bildad first states, does God pervert judgment and does the Almighty pervert justice?
Mm.
And Job answers him in both cases.
Mm.
But we review Job's answer. Let's kind of sum up, you know, Bildad for a minute, you know, because this is who he's answering. I mean, he's bringing the case against God, but, you know, he's answering what we read in the last chapter. And remember, we talked about, you know, Bildad basically had this retribution theology or a pain and compensation theory. You know, so he kind of has this attitude that God is so powerful and great, he could not do unjust things.
Mm.
You know, he has this kind of a premise and a conclusion. The premise is that God is powerful and great, and a conclusion is he cannot do injustice.
Mm.
But Job says to him, it is true, God can and did all these great things, but that does not mean he does justice. This is the argument he's bringing. So let's look at this for a second. Because he stated, although I cannot step into the ring with God, because he's powerful and can turn my words around. I have no power before him. Nonetheless, power and justice are two different things. He's separating these two things. And you, he's saying to Bildad, cannot prove that because God is powerful, that that necessarily makes him just at the same time. I know. So Job kind of refutes the first argument that power is synonymous with judgment, and then the second argument that the righteous individual survives the scourge, you know, because he says God has given over the world to wickedness. He covers the faces. In other words, he hides the truth from the judges. Don't you see? I'm telling you the truth. And he's hiding the truth from the judges. Otherwise, they would judge justly, and they haven't. And he's saying none of this could happen without God's approval. So therefore, God is the one that's responsible. And if not him, then who? Tell me. If it's not God, then who?
He's the one who's allowed it to happen.
Right. And so this is where we get back to this point that this is exactly the point of view of so many people again. If there's a God, why is there war? If there's a God, why is there famine? If there's a God, why is there violence? If there's a God, why is there crime? If there's a God, why do bad things happen to children? Why do children die? Why do people get sick? How could there be a Holocaust? How could God allow these things? But Job's view is a bit different, though, than those kind of people, which are typically your modern-day atheists, you know, or the people who have turned away from God. They want some kind of spirituality, but they deny the existence of God. Because he continues to accept that there's a God. But he says, if God allows these things, as he said earlier, then it really doesn't matter at all if you're good or bad, because everybody gets the same fate.
Sure.
And so again, I think Job's view of God is greater than his friends, because he recognizes the foolishness of man, or he's trying to say, look, it's foolish for man to ever think he could be right before God through his own actions, because look at me, you know, I tried. You know, he's kind of recognizing this incredible distance between, you know, God and man. I mean, look, Isaiah said it best in Isaiah 55:8, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, he's confronted with the absolute weakness that he has and emptiness when he stands before God, because the terror of God is upon him. And what happens? You know, look, what does the scripture say? The fear of God is Rishit Chokmah, the beginning of wisdom. But it's only the beginning.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
You know, and this is the thing. It's only the beginning.
And so he goes on to say, now my days are swifter than a runner. They flee away. They see no good. They pass like a swift, like swift ships, like an eagle swooping on its prey. If I say, I will forget my complaints, I will put off my sad face and wear a smile, I'm afraid of all my sufferings. I know that you will not hold me innocent. If I am condemned, why then do I labor in vain? If I wash my face with snow water, if I cleanse my hands with soap, yet you will purge me into the pit, and my own clothes will abhor me.
Right. So, you know, in verse 26, in verse 26, it talks about reed boats. They have passed on like reed boats, or you said something about boats, like an eagle swoops upon its food. And so reed boats were actually used in the Nile, you know, in Mitzrayim in Egypt and elsewhere, because they were made of reeds, they had a short lifespan. They could only be used a couple of times before they stopped floating. And so he's kind of giving this idea again of how, you know, his days are slipping away and he's despairing for life. You know, what's the reason for living, you know, if this is what my life is based on? Doing good to gain God's favor, you know, this is wrong. You know, he's asking that question in a sense. You know, am I so wrong for wanting to find favor with God? If I say I will forget my complaint, that I will leave behind my face, you know, what he's basically saying is leave behind my face, the face that I'm living with now, this sadness, this terror, this anguish, and be cheerful. You know, I fear all my sorrow. I know that you will not purify me. And there's that word again. We see...
that's different. I know that you will not purify me. It's different to saying, I know that you will not hold me innocent.
Right, because in verse 28, it says, Yagorti kol atzvotai yidati kilo tinakini. There's that naki again. Remember we talked about that naki in the tzaddik. And that naki is one who's clean or purified. And so this is what it's saying. I fear all my sorrow. I know that you will not purify me. Because he goes on. He's saying, look, I'd like to forget the complaint I have against God and put on a smile. But he can't because his pain doesn't stop because he's saying, you know, God won't relent. And then, Anochi Ersha Lamazeh Hevel Iga, I am wicked. Why should I toil in futility? And really what he's saying is if I'm counted as wicked, why should I labor to do what's right? And that why should I toil in futility is really powerful. Because remember, he's saying, look, it doesn't matter. He's basically making the argument, it doesn't matter. If I do good or if I do bad, I'm going to get the same reward or punishment. And in this case, it's the punishment.
Yeah.
You know, if I bathe myself through snow and cleanse my palms with lye, what does he say? He says,
Az bashachat, into the pit.
Az bashachat, you know, titbeleni v'tiavuni shlamotai. Then in the pit you will dip me and my outer garment will abhor me. And we know that the pit is a common symbol of death, you know, or Sheol. We've talked about this, the pit. And he says, no matter how clean I make myself, I'm still going to die. And even and my garments, my clothing will abhor the rotting body that I'm living in, you know, now. I can't imagine what he looks like at this point. We don't even know. We don't even know what the time frame is. You know, we don't even know what the time frame is. Remember, we talked about the clumps on him and all these different things.
And, you know, every time when I go searching for artwork to use as, the cover picture for these posts, I think, boy, these artworks are so kind to Job. You know, what we're reading paints an entirely different picture, something far more horrific than what we see in these works of art when it comes to the story of Job. But, oh, my goodness. That even his own clothes.
Well, remember,
were
they didn't read Hebrew.
No,
like most people.
That's it. And so, verse 32 goes on: "For he is not a man as I am, that I may answer him, and that we should go to court together." There it is again: that we should go to court. Nor is there any mediator between us.
He's saying, "I wish there was somebody, but there isn't."
Nor is there any mediator between us who may lay his hand on both of us. Let him take his rod away from me, and do not let dread of him terrify me. Then I would speak and not fear him, but it is not so with me.
Yeah, so I mean, here we have, I mean, of course, he's recognizing who God is, and he's saying, look, how could I come together with him in court? How could I actually, that we might come together in judgment, it says in verse 32. There is no mediator between us that will put his hand on the two of us. Mm. You know, how can he do that? There is no mediator that can come, you know, because God is not going to appear in court with him. You know, certainly this begs the question, and I know people are going to have to look at this verse and make their own sense of it. But look, this is the source document and the evidence for our faith. And so we need to, you know, without going deeply into this, I mean, this is really something to consider, this verse, what Job is talking about here. And he's basically saying, look, we are in such a different class of existence than God is. There's no way that he can be accountable to us, or that anyone might act as a mediator between us. There's no way that we can have that kind of relationship with God in a courtroom. Let him take away his rod from upon me, and let not the dread of him terrify me, in verse 34. And he says, then he would relent, if he would stop terrifying me, if he would take his rod away from me and stop lashing out against me. He says, then I will speak and will not fear him, for now it is not so with me. Take away my troubles, that I can be relieved from this terror. And then Job says he would be happy to talk to God. He would be happy to speak to him. You can see really from this chapter that Job still maintains his innocence. And we begin to see more of the language of the courtroom introduced. And while we've maintained that Job certainly has a better understanding of God, he still has a negative view. And it would appear that since this all starts out with a divine counsel, that as Job had his way, he would really take God to court. And one might even make the argument that this is the very thing that he's doing here, that he's using his friends as both witnesses and judges of the case between he and God.
It's almost as if he's pleading for some kind of sympathy from his friends, saying, look, I would, but it's futile. It is absolutely futile because he's so high above me and there's no one between us. There's he and there's I, and what can I do? And if only he would remove, if he would take his rod away from me, you know, then then we can reason with each other, but it is not so with me. And that concludes chapter 9. And in chapter 10, there Job does continue, but he continues in a slightly different fashion. He continues pleading with God, throwing himself at the mercy of God, so to speak. And it begins with, "My soul loathes my life." But we're going to get to that. Poor Job. We're going to get to that next week.
"Do not condemn me," he cries out.
Don't condemn me, but it always makes...
But this is what he says. But here he says... I mean, this is what's so funny about him. I mean, I know we're going to talk about this next week, but, you know, here's what's funny. He just gets finished saying, "Look, if the terror was released from me, I would bring my complaint. I would speak to God." And then here he goes... Here he says to me, "Let me know what your charge is with me." Bring the charge against me. You know, so this is why I say he's bringing his case now, and he's using his friends as witnesses and judges.
We're going to see that next week in chapter 10. Ira Michelson, my friend, thank you for coming back onto Truth to You for Treasures from the Tanakh.
Thank you, my friend.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure having you on. And thank you to the listeners who leave comments and questions. Appreciate that. But until next week, we have to leave poor Job in this condition for another week. Until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.